in the laws of Christianity, may we find inspiration and faith from this solemn day.
This country is at war with Germany.
Hello, I'm Pam Rhodes, and you're listening to When We Prayed in World War II, a podcast from the Eternal Wall of Answered Prayer, produced by Premier. In this series, we're looking at the history of World War II through the lens of prayer. We'll examine the progress of the war, using as our guide the seven national days of prayer called by King George VI during the conflict.
I have asked that Sunday next should be observed as a day of national prayer.
And everybody poured out of every house. Every single person came out, and we walked up to church.
We'll find out when and why the king asked his people to look to God for help. And we'll investigate some of the remarkable things that happened after the British nation was brought to its knees in prayer. We'll hear audio and historical accounts from the time, alongside memories of answered prayers, miraculous escapes or unexplained turn of events at home and abroad. Some have been passed down through family members. Others are recorded in diary entries. And sometimes we'll hear the voices of those who experienced them firsthand. So let's begin episode one.
At this time, the Columbia Broadcasting System takes you to London for the special Empire Day address of King George VI.
His Majesty the King.
The 24th of May, 1940. King George VI is broadcasting a radio address to the nation and the Commonwealth.
At this fateful hour we turn, as our fathers before us have turned, in all times of trial, to God the Most High.
The Nazis were proving a formidable challenge. British forces were in trouble. And the sovereign decided, with the agreement of the new Prime Minister, to call his subjects to join him in a day of prayer.
Let us, with one heart and soul, humbly but confidently, commit our cause to God.
The King had to call it. It was very important because it was suggested, I think, by Winston Churchill, who wanted prayer. The king himself wanted prayer. Very shy man with very difficult speaking, as you know. But he was very anxious that we had prayers.
Anne-Marie Parker moved to Hertfordshire the day before World War II began. She was looking forward to starting at her new school.
I was seven. My brother was five. We knew nothing about a war coming, except obviously my parents did.
It was barely two decades after the devastation and heartache of World War I when, despite the best efforts of Neville Chamberlain's government, Britain was pulled reluctantly into a second global conflict. If you're new to World War II history, let me give you some brief context. Adolf Hitler had been rising in popularity in Germany for years. The Nazi leader played on his country's disappointment and hardship following their defeat in the First World War, as he told them of his plans to conquer Europe. An English vicar, writing in a parish magazine in August 1939, captures the uncertainty.
The international situation dominates all our thoughts. By the time the magazine reaches you, things will probably have changed considerably, either for the better, as we hope, or for the worse.
Hitler ordered his army to invade Poland just before dawn, on Friday, the 1st of September. For 48 hours, there was a flurry of diplomatic activity to and fro across Europe. The Allies had pledged to protect Poland in the event of a German invasion. And so Britain and France now urgently tried to persuade Hitler to withdraw, but to no avail.
We were playing in the garden. We were running up and down. My mother put the radio on and she called me up and said, "I want you to listen to this."
You will now hear a statement by the Prime Minister.
"I am speaking to you from the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street."
It was a Sunday morning at 11:15. Across Britain, many people were in church, probably praying, at the very moment that Neville Chamberlain addressed the nation to say that earlier that morning he'd sent an ultimatum to Hitler, giving the German leader until 11 a.m. to leave Poland, or the Allies would be obliged to declare war against him.
He was a good man. He knew we were entering evil times. And he'd done his best, but he wasn't a strong man. And he said,
"I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany."
He was a very definite Christian man, and he ended his speech with a prayer.
"Now may God bless you all, and may he defend the right, for it is evil things that we shall be fighting against: brute force, bad faith, injustice, oppression."
Some church leaders shared the news with their congregation and led them in a prayer. A local paper in Reading stated,
"Special biddings were made for the King and Prime Minister and other officials, and that evening the litany was sung as intercession for all concerned."
So the very first act in Britain right at the start of World War II, probably in hundreds if not thousands of churches across the country, was almost certainly to pray. For Neville Chamberlain, Germany's advances had come as a huge disappointment. Less than a year had passed since he'd returned, full of hope, from Munich, brandishing a piece of paper signed by the Führer, pledging peace in our time.
"You can imagine what a bitter blow it is to me that all my long struggle to win peace has failed. Yet I cannot believe that there is anything more or anything different that I could have done and that would have been more successful."
In some cases, warfare can be acceptable because the alternative, i.e. doing nothing, is fundamentally unacceptable. And of course, the Second World War is a classic example of where doing nothing, appeasing Hitler's Germany, whatever one wants to call it, would have been quite the wrong thing to do.
Major General Roddy Porter is a Christian who served several tours of duty during his 30-year career in the British Army. He spent many years studying the just war theory.
"For those who believe in the just war tradition, sometimes taking action, sometimes going to war, is better than doing nothing. And then you get into a very interesting dilemma about when Jesus says to us, you must love your enemies and pray for those who hate you. So you love your enemy, yet you are enjoined by your government to kill them."
Chamberlain was at pains to make a distinction between the German people and the Nazi doctrine, saying, "We have no quarrel with the German people, except that they allow themselves to be ruled by a Nazi government." Now that Britain was at war, a series of measures were immediately put in place. The information was broadcast over the radio and declared in the street by people called common criers.
"Fire the king! A proclamation specifying the articles to be treated as contraband of war.
All places of entertainment were to be closed with immediate effect, and people were discouraged from crowding together, with one notable exception, to attend church. So, for many in Britain, their first act of national service, if you like, on behalf of the king and country, was to petition the King of Kings, their Heavenly Father. And the only thing permitted in the country at that time, in terms of people gathering together outside work, was to worship their Creator and pray. More than 80 years on, the stories we like to remember about Britain in World War II are the ones of heroism and valour, of digging for victory, and of British people prepared by Churchill to fight them on the beaches before letting their sceptred isle succumb to Nazi rule. The reality, though, was very mixed. War is brutal, and World War II remains the deadliest conflict in world history. According to journalist Andrew Marr in his book, The Making of Modern Britain, the early months of the war were, in fact, shaped by defeat. Not a great deal happened on land at the beginning. The first 8 months are known as the Phony War, or in German, the Sitzkrieg. But when Hitler decided to move on the ground, the Nazis swept through Europe with terrifying speed.
The Germans had launched this very successful, what's called Blitzkrieg, lightning attack.
Through Denmark, Norway, the Netherlands and Luxembourg, Belgium's sudden collapse put the Allies on the back foot, and France, even with the support from the British Expeditionary Force, was struggling to withstand the power and sophistication of the German attack.
They had encircled the British forces into a fairly narrow corridor, one end being the beaches near Dunkirk.
John Scriven's father was there in May 1940 when almost the entire British armed forces found themselves stranded and cut off on the coast of northern France, with German tanks advancing towards them on land, Luftwaffe overhead, and a 26-mile expanse of water behind them. The English Channel, which served as such protection for Britain from a land invasion, now a deadly obstacle blocking her troops' only route to survival.
The situation was absolutely dire.
Royal Navy ships were out in the channel but couldn't navigate the shallow water to reach more than a tenth of the men on Dunkirk Beach. Hundreds of thousands of British troops were in peril.
In the evening of 23rd of May, Alan Brooke, who was commanding the 2nd Corps of the BEF, wrote in his diary these words: "Nothing but a miracle can save the BEF now, and the end cannot be far off."
Scriven, who is a Christian and former member of the Territorial Army, has co-authored a book, Beyond the Odds, looking at some of the miraculous turning points in Britain's wars. Winston Churchill, who'd only been made Prime Minister a few days earlier, scheduled a speech in Parliament and warned the House to expect hard and heavy tidings. He later said that the situation was so desperate, he prepared himself to have to announce the greatest military disaster in our long history. And then the new Prime Minister and King George VI made a decision.
"I have asked that Sunday next should be observed as a day of national prayer."
In the Bible, in the book of Isaiah, chapter 65, verse 24, the Lord says, "It will come to pass that before they call, I will answer, and while they are still speaking, I will hear. In Matthew's Gospel, in chapter 6, Jesus says to his followers, "Your Father knows what you need before you ask him." So it's interesting that something very significant now happens. Hitler makes what is widely recognised as one of the biggest strategic errors in military history. He decides to stop the land advance on Dunkirk. On the day, the king announces the day of prayer, but before Britain has even come together as a nation to do it, it is a momentous decision and one that historians still can't explain. Was it because Churchill and the king called the nation to pray? Who can say for sure? Hitler's reasons will probably never be known. But the fact remains that with almost the entire British expeditionary force in desperate straits, under attack, out of food and ammunition, and seemingly right within his grasp, the German leader suddenly decides to order the bulk of his army to halt. One of his top generals, Karl von Rundstedt, who advised him on that day, later called it one of the great turning points of the war. Meanwhile, back in Britain, anxious with inactivity and mostly unaware of this change, people at home were eager to pray. Vast numbers responded to the king's call, keen to do something, anything, to help the war effort and bring their loved ones home.
His Majesty called the Empire to a day of prayer, and on that day, in every place of worship throughout this great Commonwealth of Nations, men and women prayed for strength in the battle against the forces of evil.
We lived down on something called the Ware Road, which was the main road between Ware and Hartford, and everybody poured out of every house. Every single person came out, and we walked up to church. When we got there, we could not get in. It was packed. It was absolute. So there were over 1,000 people. I still cannot believe it.
People from all denominations came together, in many cases for the first time.
I saw one or two of my friends who were Catholics. It was the first time, I think I'm right in saying, certainly in Harvard, I presume elsewhere, where all the faiths came together. You know, there wasn't, oh, I'm a Catholic or I'm a Protestant, you know. It was very, very interesting to see everybody. And we all stood there very, very quietly.
Those who couldn't get in thronged the streets outside in their thousands. Photographs of the queue to get into Westminster Abbey show crowds stretching around the block.
The Prime Minister was followed by Mr. Neville Chamberlain, and the service was conducted by the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Young or old, wealthy or poor.
The King and Queen attended, the King in the uniform of the Royal Air Force.
No one was above bending the knee at what the King called this fateful hour.
A prominent figure in the congregation was Mr. Attlee, and another royal worshipper was Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands.
Across the Commonwealth, people prayed. In Australia, a local mayor confidently expected that every citizen would exhibit his loyalty to the King and the British Empire by attending the special services that had been arranged. And after everyone prayed, they waited. Stay with us for part two to find out what happened next and the miracles that took place on the beaches of Dunkirk.
Be inspired by hearing how God is working through the lives of people all across the world. Hear of miracles and prayers being answered. Sign up to the newsletter of the Eternal Wall of Answered Prayer today, and keep updated on the plans to build a giant monument to help us remember that God does indeed hear and answer our prayers. Just head to answeredprayer.org.uk now.
As we heard in part one, Winston Churchill had attended the prayer service at Westminster Abbey, which was at 10 a.m. According to the National Archives, He came straight from a meeting of his war cabinet, one of three meetings they would hold that day. Immediately after the first National Day of Prayer had taken place, one of the next things to happen within a few hours is a crucial change of mood at the highest levels of the British government. In the morning, the prospects for Britain looked incredibly grim. Having sent his tanks and troops away from Dunkirk 2 days earlier, Hitler now had second thoughts. In his diary, Churchill's predecessor, Neville Chamberlain, who was still a member of the War Cabinet, described Sunday, the 26th of May 1940, as the blackest day of all. Lord Halifax, then Foreign Secretary, began to push the idea of negotiating peace with Hitler. If he had won his argument that day, the history of the war and the second half of the 20th century in Europe would have looked very different indeed. But he didn't. Later that same day, just hours after Britain had been brought to its knees in prayer, the Chiefs of Staff produced a second assessment of the situation. It was entitled British Strategy in the Near Future, and it concluded,
Germany has most of the cards, but the real test is whether the morale of our fighting personnel and civil population will counterbalance the numerical and material advantages which Germany enjoys. We believe it will.
We believe it will. Britain's National Archives describe those words and the optimism enshrined in that paper, which arrived at such a crucial time, as a rare ray of light in the darkness. They record this paper, written by the Chiefs of Staff, as one of the most important documents of the Second World War. This was just hours after the nation had prayed. Although Germany's tanks had been halted by Hitler 2 days earlier, its air force had not. In fact, just the opposite. In the skies above, the Luftwaffe continued to rain down bombs and bullets onto Dunkirk's beaches. The RAF was making a valiant attempt to protect the Allied soldiers below, but their pilots, though brave, were vastly outnumbered. The enemy planes were launching from an airbase a few miles from Dunkirk, and now we see another unexpected turn of events.
Somebody told me this, who was in the war, and he said the Germans had a small aerodrome probably about 10 or 20 miles from Dunkirk. And they actually bombed the men on the beach from there. Somebody said, let's say a prayer. And then what happened was that suddenly there was an enormous storm. It didn't touch the beach at Dunkirk, but it touched that aerodrome. It just touched that aerodrome and the planes couldn't get up. So the bombing stopped. And then, of course, there were thousands of little boats. They put out an SOS, who's anybody's got a boat from anywhere. And some of those people did two journeys.
Many of us know the story of Dunkirk so well now, don't we?
British ships, cruisers, destroyers, yachts, paddle boats, anything that could float.
Stories have been told, books have been written, it's even been made into a movie. At the British government's request, thousands of civilian boats set sail from the south coast to help rescue well over 300,000 Allied troops in a daring evacuation attempt.
The Admiralty want men experienced in marine internal combustion engines for service as enginemen in yachts or motorboats. Others who have had charge of motorboats and have good knowledge of coastal navigation are needed as uncertified second hands. Application should be made to the nearest registrar.
Nobody knew if the effort would succeed or fail. So many factors could come against it. The weather forecast was one. But whether it was God or chance or science, the conditions were truly remarkable. Let me explain. Number one, not only did the storm cover only the German aerodrome, grounding the planes and stopping the bombs. Number two, with the rain, the marshy ground between the stranded Allies on the beaches and the German front line now became even softer and muddier, creating an extra layer of protection. Richard Gamble is the founder of the Eternal Wall of Answered Prayer and has researched some of the prayers that were answered at Dunkirk itself.
Now, I know storms happen. That's just life, right? But what's amazing is, while that storm is happening, just 100 kilometres away, the weather is completely different. The sea at Dunkirk, some generals describe it as being like glass. It's perfect for this armada of civilian vessels to come in, the fishermen boats, the sailing boats, the holiday boats, to come and rescue the lads on the beaches.
The Daily Telegraph wrote at the time, "Those who are accustomed to the Channel testify to the strangeness of this calm. They are deeply impressed by the phenomenon of nature by which it became possible for tiny craft to go back and forth in safety." That's number three. Would you like to hear number four?
Not only is the sea just like glass, but there's also cover of fog. So even for a lot of the Air Force, they found it difficult to navigate, to actually attack these ships. And if that's not enough, if Hitler's decision or the weather conditions are not enough, there's actually accounts of this incredible immunity that some of the soldiers had. One group of 400 soldiers had this consistent attack coming in from what was left of the German Air Force to attack. And when the attack finished, 400 of them stood up and just couldn't believe that none of them were hit. None of them were even injured. One of the chaplains of that group of 400 gives the account that he threw himself down to the ground, you know, lay in the sand, was just praying to God for help. And when it went to silence, he got up and checked himself just to see where he'd been hit. But he hadn't. And he looked down at the sand, and there was his silhouette in the sand made up of German bullets.
The Dunkirk rescue is the largest amphibious evacuation ever undertaken in wartime. In total, over 338,000 men were rescued aboard nearly 900 vessels. 10 times as many lives were saved as had originally been hoped. It didn't come without cost. Many ships were lost in the attempt, including Royal Navy destroyers. When Churchill described it to Parliament later, he paid tribute to the valour, perseverance, discipline and skill shown by those involved. And he also called it a miracle of deliverance. So how did those rescued feel about what happened? You can bet they also had prayed. Reg Baisley from Bewdley in Worcester was one of those brought home.
I was hauled aboard the Mansman. I've never appreciated anything so much as I did that mug of thick, sweet cocoa that was shoved in my hand. All we had to do now was pray. I remember thinking, please God, let the bombers miss us. What we had witnessed there was carnage. But soon, far ahead, we could see the cliffs of Dover, and I can tell you, it was a glorious sight.
The book We Remember Dunkirk by Frank Shaw, published in 2013, tells the story of Harold J. Chalker from Weymouth in Dorset.
I remember once when some mates and I and some other soldiers had great fears and started to pray in earnest for God to protect us. We had some more sleep in the sand dunes until about 5 p.m. when we scrambled for a small boat offshore. We waded up to our necks to reach the boat. As we got to it, about 40 soldiers tried to get in at once. You can imagine the result. We were all soaked to the skin again. We were taken off the beaches shortly afterwards on a paddle steamer called the Royal Eagle and arrived at Sheerness the next morning.
Mary Collins from Weymouth in Dorset shares how she witnessed the return of the men.
I do not think there was a dry eye amongst the watching women as the trucks went by filled with young soldiers. They were dressed in the most motley assortment of clothes, uniforms and jackets. It was so many years ago, but the memory of those boys is still quite clear. I can still see their faces expressing elation, relief and exhaustion. I remember that we all thanked God that they had been saved. We didn't have them long in Yeovil because they were sent to other units to carry on with the war, but I never fail to thank God for the little boats that brought them back from the hell of Dunkirk.
In the days before social media, people shared their views by writing to the editor of a newspaper, as they still can today, in the hope that it might get published. A letter to the Times on the 5th of June from a Mr. Basil Sullivan in Putney acknowledged the importance of the National Day of Prayer in the Dunkirk rescue. It reads,
Sir, the British Expeditionary Force has with incomparable courage fought its way out of the German ring of steel and fire. The fortitude displayed and the success achieved are to me at least miracles and an answer to the prayers which rose up from the Empire and from millions outside of it on May 26th. Let us not forget to return thanks.
The next letter from H. Molesworth in Warrington is similar.
Sir, just over a week ago, we were most of us on our knees imploring God for his help. Surely our prayers have been answered in the most merciful deliverance of our expeditionary force from complete destruction.
The section in the Times begins by saying, these letters are two out of a very large number they had received on the topic. Mr. Molesworth went on.
Thanksgiving is surely as important as supplication, and there must be many who feel like myself that we ought to have a special day of thanksgiving to God for his wonderful answer to our prayers.
The Archbishop of Canterbury agreed and wrote to nominate the following Sunday. And so on the 9th of June, Britain went back to church to give thanks for lives saved and in recognition that the prayers of the nation had been answered. One thing can be certain about tomorrow's Thanksgiving in our churches, wrote the Telegraph. From none will the thanks ascend with greater sincerity or deeper fervour than from the officers and men who have seen the hand of God, powerful to save, delivering them from the hands of a mighty foe who, humanly speaking, had them utterly at his mercy. In total, there were seven national days of prayer called by the King and the British government during the war. This podcast looks at the events that took place before and after each one. And we'll share other stories of prayers that were answered at home and abroad during the conflict. Like Wendy Adams' mother Beryl, who as a child during the war asked God to return her precious Bible, which she lost when her school in Bournemouth was bombed.
Imagine my amazement when 18 months later, when I was in a different school and in a different town, I turned to find my original Bible sitting on my school desk. It had been rescued by a workman who was clearing the debris from my bombed school. He had found it, intact. He had come to my new school and asked a girl in my class if she knew anyone by my name. The Bible was placed on my desk, and I was just so thrilled to think God was able to care for me and answer my prayer in this way.
Beryl's story is already recorded in The Eternal Wall of Answered Prayer, and yours could be too. A team of staff and volunteers are gathering 1 million answered prayers to be permanently exhibited in a national monument in the UK as a testimony to God's faithfulness through the generations. To learn more about The Eternal Wall or to submit your story of answered prayer, go to eternalwall.org. UK. Thank you for listening and join us next time.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of When We Prayed. If so, we have an amazing free gift waiting for you at answeredprayer.org.uk/podcast. You can get a free personal and small group Bible study which accompanies this series. Explore how God answered prayers in the Bible throughout history and continues to do so today. This free resource is available at answeredprayer.org.uk/podcast.